What would you do, Clinton, if you suddenly were made the head of the Cochos? You know, everybody left, ran away, and you had total carte blanche to start something. What would you do?
Well, I would emphasize frameworks and concepts as the heritage of the white colonial patriarchy. And then I would point out how McLuhan was inviting us all to escape and build anti-environments and find new ways of being that exist outside of these totalitarian frameworks. And I would point to economics as a whole, especially structuring your view of society in these hierarchies or these flows through industry, and how Marxism just recapitulates and hegemonizes. And again, I wouldn't use these words. I'm summarizing for you, right? Or I would use these words, because these are the sort of words that the people who are there want to be have things spoken to in them, right? You got to meet the audience where they're at. So if everyone attending the Coach House seminars are fucking U of T students, then you got to speak to them about hegemonies and all that shit, right? So right after our land acknowledgement, we would get into an exploration of how the discourse of critical theory is a totalizing framework structure, which is precisely emblematic of white male patriarchal conceptual thinking, which enslaves people. And then I would point out how acoustical space and modes of space perception are ways of exploring our embodied nature and our relations to reality that let us slip outside of these concepts and these figures and these models and these structures and these frameworks, let us, you know, look outside of the jargon, the cliches, which completely surround us, like fighting the cliches, making a manifest of all the cliches, pointing them out, and then finding a way to step outside of them would be the long-term project. And that can be through language, but it would also be through an attempt, right? Like, the whole point of critical theory, the word critical implies we need to be hard on ourselves, right? We need to be self-reflexive. This is going back to the second wave of cyberneticists in the 60s, in some sense, the focus on reflexivity, the focus on you know, we can't just look at the world. We have to look at ourselves and be critical to ourselves. But it's become moribund and calcified, and there's nothing critical left in critical theory except attacking straw men, right? So, yeah, that's sort of the direction that I would try to do some judo moves there.
Right. What was your opening sentence? You said something about the white dominance. I didn't get your first sentence.
In the frameworks that are being shoved down everyone's fucking throat, right? Rigid logical categories and models and frameworks and conceptual thinking, i.e. what we call visual space, is a white male patriarchal colonial construct for domination of economics and enslavement of people to, you know, plantation logic and all this stuff, right? Like, they look at being logical and being literate and visual space as purely a colonial white person thing, which disrupted and is destroying indigenous ways of knowing and feminine ways of being. Right, feminine ways of being and indigenous knowledge is under attack by visual space. That's where critical theory is at right now, and that
you would update that. You would McLuhanize that.
I think I would try to update that rather than trying to be some alleged right winger railing against it, as you know, because that's what everyone's trying to do. You know, is rail against critical theory.
That's good. Would you make a journal? How would you communicate this stuff? Would you just have seminars and discussions at the Cochos?
I would do commentaries on many, many, many trending and well-known and popular pieces. Like, you know, The Social Dilemma was big, right? But instead of talking about how they, you know, right, it's like, use these things, but make commentaries on them that illuminate the actual nature of the environment according to my free software open source thing. Obviously, I would be bringing in the free software shit a lot, and the Linux shit a lot, and the black boxing, and the, you guys don't even understand computers. No one taught you computers. They took away your ability to learn computers, right? I'd be railing on that shit a lot, and I would be in communication with the, you know, the cyborg thinking people and the post-human people who like, you know, doing hacker stuff and modifying their bodies and you know, sticking little gadgets in their under their skin and all this dumb shit that these post-human people do, while trying to emphasize that they don't need to attack humanity or humanism in order to be right. The alienation that one feels as, you know, technologically augmented doesn't make you against traditional humanism and conservatism. It ought not to, as a foregone conclusion, right? Like,
say that again. What's not a foregone conclusion?
There's lots of highly technically minded people who are at war against fucking, you know, modern regular people because they're alienated from popular culture that knows nothing about technology and ignores them and thinks that they're dumb or nerds or something, right? Yeah. I don't fit in with mainstream culture because I'm big into technology, therefore, you know, fuck conservatives and we are the new freaky, you know, post-human cyborgs here to embrace, you know, like, just destroy all your binaries and your categories and subvert.
What about those people you would invite in?
I would invite him, and I would invite them in, but I also wouldn't mindlessly capitulate to their angry counterculture, identity questing violence. I would note the cultural violence in their quest for identity, as McLuhan pointed out, right? But also I wouldn't you know, unequivocally support it or affirm it as
right
as,
so you would basically we sometimes do that on this show. We talk that way. We do patterns from the McLuhan angle or the Croker angle, and you talk about your stack media stuff. So what you would do would include what we're doing.
Oh, here. Sure, yeah, yeah, we do a lot of stuff here. Yeah.
And then would you have a journal, and it would be different from the present explorations journal?
Oh, goodness. Yeah, the editorial policy would be so radically different, I don't know if it would constitute a journal or not. I mean, listen, schools, again, this is a hypothetical where I'm running the Kojos, but in the larger university structure, a journal exists for students to get their stuff published in. And so students would just be writing on stuff, and that's what happens with New Explorations, right? It's a way for, you know, I wrote a paper, I can get it published, oh, please, yay, I got accepted in a peer-reviewed journal, yay, right? That's just a part of being a student, and so the school is providing that experience. I wouldn't want to do a journal like that.
Yeah.
I don't want to do a, right? So, certainly, I mean, the traditional university structure would hate me too, just like they hated McLuhan, right?
Right.
I'm not sure how I got in the position of Coach House director, but if I did, they would hate me. Would I do a journal? Yes, but I would be so prescriptivist and tight about the editorial control and so critical on the publication front, then no one would be able to get published in it. So, I don't mean no one would be able to get published in it.
What'd you just say? You'd be so what, strict?
I'd be so critical that no one would be able to get published in it. Standards would be too high.
That's interesting. Okay, so, a little digression. So I got out my George Sanderson book, and it's called Marshall McLuhan, The Man and His Message, edited by George Sanderson and Frank McDonald, introduction by John Cage, published in Fulcrum Incorporated in Golden, Colorado. So pretty small publisher, I assume.
Huh.
So can you look at your copy? Let me give you some
not,
of the people.
That's not what I have. That's not what I have.
Yeah, that's right. But I want to see how much is in yours, which came out in 88, and this is 89.
Okay, so we got I'm a Cleveland Mosaic.
No, I'll read you what I got here. You've got comments by Claude Bissell. Is that in yours?
It's called Herbert Marshall McLuhan.
Yeah.
Yeah, I got that.
You got Marshall McLuhan with Louis Forsdale, Technology and Human Dimension.
Yes, correct.
McLuhan as teacher, the St. Louis years, Walter Ong.
And then I got McLuhan Prose by McLuhan, The Role of New Media by McLuhan. I got The Unknown McLuhan by Cooper, Media Inflation Crowd back to McLuhan, McLuhan Festival on the Road to San Francisco by Gerald Fine or Fegan. Yeah, so it's probably the same book under a different title then, eh?
Yeah, because it's got Marshalling, then McLuhan's At the Moment of Sputnik, and then it's the same order. Marshall McLuhan, Mady Molinaro.
Yep.
Then McLuhan Probes, Marshall McLuhan. Then Violence of the Media by McLuhan.
Yep.
Then a John Culkin thing, Marshall's
yep.
New York Adventure.
Then the Symposium.
Then a Jane Jacobs. And then yep. a McLuhan article. Then Fred Thompson. Got that?
Yeah. Okay, it's the same book. That's good.
Yeah, so it's published by him locally in 88.
Uh-huh, yes.
Yeah, and then he does this. He gets a publisher in the States. So you even got down page, you've got, after Thompson, you've got Barry Nevitt with some McLuhan stuff, and then Louis Forsdale again, then
yep.
Wilson Brian Key. You got that?
Yep.
And then Eric, and then George Sanderson. Yeah, it's exactly the same book.
Yeah.
Does yours have an introduction by John Cage?
Nope. It's got McLuhan and Our Times by George Sanderson, Acknowledgements by George Sanderson, and then it goes straight into a McLuhan mosaic. So the John Cage thing is new to your book.
Yeah. And it's only a page and a half. It's not that long. As a matter of fact, let me read it, since it's kind of might be interesting.
Sure.
He says, at one of our meetings in the 60s, Marshall McLuhan suggested that I write some music using the 10 thunderclaps at Finnegan's Wake. They were a history, he said, of technology, and they were the subject of a book by his son. And CBO 66, Eric had a book of the media of the thunders at Finnegan's Wake, and he was trying to get it published in New York, and it didn't happen, but it's discussed. It's referenced in War and Peace in the Global Village. They have the chart of the Thunders in 1968. That's
yeah.
as far as he got back then. So Cage knew about that, or maybe even got to read it. Yeah, he says, I received a typescript of the book from Eric McLuhan and fully intended to make something called Atlas Borealis with the 10 thunderclaps. It would have been for orchestra and chorus transformed electronically so that the singing would fill the envelopes of actual thunderclaps. Thunderclaps, and the playing of the strings, those of actual raindrops, falling first on Earth, successively on different materials down through history, and finally remaining in the air. Going to the concert would have been like going to a storm. I never started it, he said. At the university, so he was going to, but at the University of Illinois, where I was invited to work with a computer facility, the composition harpsichord, but without the vowels, HPSCHD, took 2 years rather than one. It was through Mildred Constantine of the Museum of Modern Art in New York City, known in Rockland County, where I was living, as Connie Bettelheim. Rockland County is where I think Gert Stern and them had their multimedia commune. Cage was sort of part of that, member of that. So he says, it was through Mildred Constantine of the Museum of Modern Art in New York City that I first heard of Marshall McLuhan. I never heard this sentence before. She was enthusiastic. And after reading McLuhan's article, The Egg and Bite of Outwit, in Location magazine in 1963, and then more recently, Taiyuanyi 1, so was I. I don't know why he puts more recently, because, you know, he didn't redo McLuhan, unless he did, in 1985. He looked at him again. But anyways, Location magazine article, and I think Arella, forget Arella's last name, Arella had John Cage on her show on CKLN in 1984-85. And she knew the McLuhan connection. She knew about my connection to McLuhan. So I was on that. We have a recording where I talked to Cage with Arella, and he sent me the location article. That's how I got it. Got it from him, because it was a New York production, just locally. Not many people had it. So anyway, so he's saying she was enthusiastic about McLuhan after reading The Egg and Bite of Outwit, which is a takeoff on a line from Ulysses by Joyce, I think. He says, in my thoughts about world improvement, I put McLuhan together with Buckminster Fuller. He quotes Bucky Fuller saying, quote, no need for politicians, they may be sent off to the moon, unquote. And then he said, Cage says, and for the source material of my current Norton lectures at Harvard, I link them, McLuhan and Fuller. They were often together at conferences in the 60s, once with Margaret Mead in Greece, 1964, for a Doxiades symposium held on a yacht in the Aegean Sea. That might have been 1963. That was McLuhan's first time on the Doxiades, this Greek architect's annual yacht thing with heavy minds of the day out in the Aegean Sea. And he went to that in 63 or so, maybe 64, and then never went back for another 8 years. He went back a second time in the early 70s. I think he was a bit disappointed of the second one. Now, my father used to say, it's Rene, if I bring up McLuhan, he'd say, oh, he's out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean with the communists. That's how he interpreted these yachts of the Aegean Sea. Communists out in the... And this is a major butler for the oligarchy speaking. My father.
The Davos conference was communists?
Beg your pardon?
The Davos conference, you mean? Like being on the yacht?
No, no. This is McLuhan. My father, I didn't know he would know anything about McLuhan. I brought him up first time, and he said, he's out in the middle of the Atlantic or the Mediterranean Sea or some major body of water with the communists. And he's referring to this yacht. Doxiades, so nothing to do with Davos. This is in the 60s.
Oh, yeah, sorry, not Davos. The conference that he was on the yacht.
The Bilderbergers.
Yeah, no. Okay, right. That's funny.
Yeah, you're thinking of the Bilderbergers in May 69. No, I think
where he was with Fuller. That's just very funny. It just, communists. Yeah, okay.
That's what my father thought. They were communists, but that's from the oligarchic point of view. They ran the communist accounts. They ran everybody. McLuhan, from my father's point of view, got locked into the communist side. But the this is one time on the yacht, 1963. It's the one time he and Bucky Fuller, and there's comments by Fuller about it, I think, somewhere. But McLuhan never went back. He kept getting invited, and Jackie Tyrwhitt, the original female member of the five that did the Explorations Communications seminar in 53 to 55, she was a student of Doxiades, and that's how McLuhan, met Doxiades through Jacqueline Tyrwhitt, who was an architect at Harvard, and she probably arranged for him to be invited. So then John Cage says, I remain stimulated and convinced, full of belief in Fuller and McLuhan. So who was the guy that we got involved with that sort of believed more in Fuller than McLuhan, but knew McLuhan, would go up and see him for a few years once a year, but McLuhan didn't like this guy and didn't talk to him. He would go up with Paul Ryan. You know who I mean? Harold Channer. Harold Channer was the guy who popularized Fuller and a bit of McLuhan. Then once I was there, we did our 10 shows or so, I made an argument between McLuhan and Fuller with him. But Harold was the only guy who could talk about it. Know enough about McLuhan. And actually visited the seminar for a couple years and said that McLuhan wouldn't talk to Harold. Ignored him. Paul Riney would have known from the Fordham seminars in 68... because he was a priest, and heard McLuhan on the radio in the 66 or so. So he found out about Fordham, and he linked up with Carpenter. So he became an assistant to Carpenter at the Fordham year, 67, 68. And that definitely would make him a friend of McLuhan's in that period. So that's why he talked to Ryan, I guess. So Cage says, I remain stimulated and convinced, full of belief in Fuller and McLuhan. If, as world people, we ever come to our senses, their separate works will help us initiate intelligent action. This book alternates articles by McLuhan himself with articles about him by people who knew him. I had been saddened in the late 60s to hear of his illness, described in the article by John Colkin. That would be the brain surgery. Mady Molinaro's article, which describes the lingering illness and silence from the time of his stroke in 77 until his death in 1980, brought tears to my eyes. Now, he had his stroke in 79, not 77. What a great loss it was for all those who are living that he died. I had lunch with him once in Toronto, and he asked me a question about pattern recognition that I couldn't answer. My mind doesn't work his way. My mind doesn't work his way. I don't always understand McLuhan, nor do I understand anything else that I actually need and can use. I don't understand anything else that he needs. Of my own work, I guess he's referring to, I don't understand anything that I actually need and can use. Of my own work, that interests me most, which I have not yet made. So he's saying what interests me is what I haven't made yet. I think that was McLuhan's attitude toward his own ideas. So Cage is saying McLuhan was like him. In his writings, in McLuhan's writings, I like the way he leaps from one paragraph to the next without transition. This also happens in the Journal of Henry David Thoreau. In brackets, quote, the best form of government is no government at all, is what Thoreau said. So then Cage ends by saying, each one leaves space in his work in which a reader stimulated can do his or her own thinking. So I think he means Fuller, McLuhan, and maybe himself. Each one leaves space in his work in which a reader stimulated can do his or her own thinking. So that's Cage's foreword, and probably no one's ever heard that. Not many people have probably have this book. So another great contribution by yours truly to the ongoing discovery of the world of McLuhan. Now, I would ask Chad, who is not really qualified in the way Clinton, hasn't the same experience. But, Chad, what would you do if you were head of the Cochos? Let's see if Chad's there. Maybe he's muted. No, he's there. What do you say, Chad? So we'll have to wait until Chad comes back. Since Greg doesn't participate in these conversations, let's see if Greg's got something to say about what we're talking about or something else. Greg is muted. There's too much absence going on here by the panel.
Well, Brian, would you run the coach house? How would you do it?
Okay, just unmuted Brian. I don't have the what you asked for, Brian. I'd have to look it up.
An unmuting war there. I'm trying to unmute myself, and it turns out I'm at the last instant, I'm unmuting myself again because I was already unmuted. Anyway, what would I do? I don't know. It's hard for me to say because I've just been reading De-Schooling Society by Ivan Illich. So, you know, I'm tempted to say, like, I would not allow any students, or I would, you know, I would just undermine school. It's just really bringing to mind the value of the whole idea of COVID proving that the university is like, is a basket case and basically dealing it a kind of a death blow. Because it really is bad.
You would not try to make it academic. You would not try to be that kind of academia.
I would try to make it partially academic. I would try to do a sort of a decad thing about it and have, you know, have it be a decathlon kind of thing, which, you know, obviously you wouldn't have to compete in all the events or something, but I would want to have as many different strains of McLuhanism going on there as I could. I would definitely want to use that space for gallery shows. An artist in residence program would be a really good idea. I would want to have Clinton come by sometimes. I would want to, you know, if, I would just bring people in for, bring smart people in. It would just be like Monday night seminars all the time, but like bringing in different people. We would definitely do some scholarly, work on trying to, you know, we would be working on, we would be swarming McLuhan topics and what is McLuhanism and how do you get that sort of, you know, it's like trying to formalize an artistic perception and apply it to sociology and anthropology and psychology and stuff. And that's great. And I want to drill down on that. But I would also be like, you know, no, we're here to be the coordinating the campaign to explore the archives and to solve the problem of there's a bunch of McLuhan stuff that no one's ever seen yet or that barely anyone has ever seen or heard. You know? I would have people doing grunt work of transcribing all of the tapes, you know, because sometimes people, it's best to read it as well as hear it, or if it's available in text online as well as in audio, so much the better, you know. I would have people taking
Like Fisher is right there. Go read McLuhan's fucking notes that he wrote in his own books. Hey,
do that.
Thomas Kuhn's, you know, science and whatever the fuck. Okay, go read McLuhan's copy. Shit like that. Yeah.
We would be raiding the Fisher and, you know, taking a field trip to Ottawa, that kind of thing. Oh, I could do some good stuff if I was the director of a place that where I'm actually going to have some students just show up because they're like, this is the McLuhan place, right? Direct me on being a student of McLuhan. I'd be like, yeah, I got ideas on how to direct you. I don't know, I'm even a lot less likely to get that job than Clinton, I think, so it's, I can afford to, so, anyway, think about it.
Do you like what Brian says, Clinton? Do you like what Brian says? You would include that?
Oh, yeah. And I like how you talk about the coordinating role, because it makes me think of the interpretation of center for culture and technology, which shows is the center for culture and technology, about which it all rotates. Like, we are the Axis Mundi of all.
Yeah.
You would emphasize that, Clinton?
Oh, yeah. This is it. This is the pole. The pole of culture. We are,
Rather than have the coach house be a center, I would make it more into the coach's office, you know, the guy who's like coordinating the team and running their, drill sergeanting their practice and then strategizing when it's time to actually go out and defeat some other team.
Let's see. So, Chad, if you're there, what if you were director? What angles would you do? You probably would agree with Brian and Clinton, but you got some other angle? You're not coming through, Chad. What's the problem there? Got to get a new connection. Maybe I should call Chad and bring him in. We can do that.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah, we can hear you now. Go ahead.
Wow, okay. I would break it up into five divisions of Bob's tiny note chart between the different quadrants and try and fit people into those different quadrants as representatives of them and have them battle out over contemporary topics and new issues and new technology and new trends happening. And then
You wouldn't just have McLuhanites there if you had the other quadrants. You'd have some Marushis there.
Yeah, I think it's important to take the tetrad to the next level and practical application and include those other quadrants.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Like you would have, you could have Zooms with these or whatever the technology is, Zooms with these different people. Actually get the, quote, enemies talking to each other, right?
Yeah, it would be like, yeah, exactly. It'd be like a new United Nations. But underlying it all would be inspired by McLuhan and then the concept of tetrad and tetrad management.
Right. And, you know, McLuhan was disappointed with his seminar after a couple of years. He said people just couldn't give up their specialty. So we would have to acknowledge that problem. But maybe it's a whole different world than McLuhan's day. People might be more interested. But that's a really good idea. The have actual people from the Thompson Quadrant. That would be the New Ager mystics, like the Daniel Schmachtenbergers, or people who are smart and up on things, but have a bias and are proud of it. And then, you know, bring Greg in. He could bring in the East German fucking intelligence agency. What were they called? The Stasi? Greg's friends with the Stasi. You see what they have to say about everything. Stasi representative. So what do you think of that, Brian and Clinton? That's a good idea. That's not everything, but that's a good addition.
Sure. I mean, I was also thinking, you know, I would make my program at the Center in Culture Technology could boast that we are the only communications dilemmas program anywhere, probably in any university, that actually treats conspiracy theory problem seriously and in a useful way, you know, like rather than, because people would love to be like, well, how are we going to solve the problem of conspiracy theories? Because it's definitely a big problem of, this is the number one problem facing communication ecology and media these days, as we all know. It's the problem that enable these terrible conspiracy theories to spread. Like, we would attack that from both form and content.
You know, Brian, what you just saying that reminded me of something. Oh, yeah. You could have someone like Whitley Webb. She's very good at doing the conspiracy thing. And she's got her facts. She's close to the way Mae Russell was. And whenever she's on media, she has an impact. She blows people away. Like Glenn Beck, he had her on. Not that he's any giant of the intellect, but he said, wow, this interview with you is the most important interview I ever did in my life. If it's someone like that who can just talk what's not being talked about in the news, but you can find, she says, I avoid intelligence documents, anything that the government could get mad at me for using. I just go with what's out there in the public journalistic record. And that's what Mae Russell did. That's what you do. You just go with what's already out there in the press. So
there's
someone
so
like
much
her would definitely be invited to speak, you know?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, look at John Brockman. He and Gerd Stern. And Brockman's a pretty amazing story. Are you guys familiar with him?
No.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. He's been funding all these smart people and conferences. He's a book publicist, right? So he represents.
Here's the way he is. He was I think he was the son of a successful New York merchant.
He was in deep with.
He got.
Yeah, he was in deep with Epstein.
But that's later. The thing is that he got attracted to Gerd Stern scene. He had a curious mind. You know, he was interested in what's going on, not just being a businessman. So he joined up with Gerd, became a student of Gerd, learned about the McLuhan world, and when Jack Nicholson and these other guys that were involved with Easy Rider the year before, they were asked by the Monkees to make a movie, and it's called Head, H-E-A-D. And Gerd was asked to design it. Gerd was linked in with these guys. So Gerd and Brockman went to Hollywood to make this Head, and Zappa was in it. And as a joke, Gerd put Brockman's head, actually his own, you know, close to it or photo of it or something, on the poster for the movies. So Brockman was, quote, you know, a butt of that joke, that his head was put on there, and he was a straight member of the group. But by 69, he did a book called By the Late John Brockman, and I read about it in East Village Other, Bowers East Village Other, and thought, oh, that's interesting. So he claimed that he had died. You know, his title was I'm Dead, and it was a collection of quotes, much like my Fatty Communion, from Bucky Fuller and McLuhan and all these interesting intellectuals. mainly around him trying to get a grasp of McLuhan and Fuller. So this collage of quotes came out and had a bit of an impact. And then the next thing is he's at Esalen listening to William Irwin Thompson argue with Ira Reiner, I forget the guy's name, who eventually was, he started Earth Day, and he eventually, he was a yippie, he got put in jail for murdering his girlfriend in 77 or something. But anyways, back in 70, John Brockman was in the audience listening to William Irwin Thompson speak, so he was impressed with that. And then he married a woman whose father was a great literary agent, influential literary agent in New York, so Brockman got into the business. So he started promoting books, people like William Irwin Thompson and scientist guys like Jack Sarfatti, but not Sarfatti per se, but those guys that did the Wulan Dancer, Dancing Wulan Masters book, Krzysztof Kapra. I think Brockman was the agent for those early guys doing counter or Zen-influenced, Krishnamurti-influenced physics. And then eventually he started a meeting in New York of a Bilderberg, well, like a McLuhan multidisciplinary seminar called the Reality Club. And I have the books they put out of their talks that Gerd had. Gerd was there. Then when the internet came on, he changes that, the Reality Club, to The Edge. So he is the first guy, probably in the mid-90s, to have all the top university academic intellectuals pushing the envelope guys. And all that was to help him get promote people he would sign. So he was a huge literary agent by the 90s. Well, somewhere in there, I don't know, around 2000, he started to have what was called billionaire dinners, and he would get the scientists that he was publishing to meet billionaires. Well, Jeffrey Epstein got in the middle of that, and he funded a lot of it and moved himself into there as a, you know, an influence on them, whatever he was trying to do. And he was hanging out with scientists all over the place, Harvard and that. He, the Dark Journalist talks about, he even, with Giselle, she had some ecological yacht movement going. They went down into the Bimini region, the hot zone they call it, and and it got in a submarine or something, went down and looked for Atlantis. Epstein was even funding that kind of stuff. So he was all over the place. So then Epstein gets in trouble in 2008, and then he's arrested 10 years later, but you know, Brockman is still using him, I think. And then when Epstein died, Brockman got scandalized, and that's 2019, so I don't know what happened to Brockman since then. But I forgot to mention that before the Reality Club, in the 70s, about 1977, one day Mark Stewart said to me, "Hey, you know about this?" and showed me a book, and I said, "No, what is it?" So it was a book by John Brockman and the guy who would become the husband of Carolyn Kennedy, you know, John Kennedy's daughter. And so he was part of the in crowd of New York, Edwin Schlossberg. They put together a book, which I have, which is worth it, of the 100 major thinkers in history, including Africans and Asians, not just Western European canon. And I think the book has quotes by these guys. It's kind of a game. They take a guy, give quotes, and then you try to guess. You might read the bio on him, then try to guess, if you don't know who it is, which quote was done by that guy. So he does 100. But what made me appreciate the book is he had McLuhan as the last guy, the 100th thinker in the history of humanity. And I agreed with that, that was the end of concepts. McLuhan moved philosophy into a new level. And I thought Brockman was smart to make their book like that. And I don't know how much the Kennedy guy, he designed museums or something in that period, and he had quite a reputation. So Schlossberg and Brockman made a good book in 77 or so. And then he, I didn't know what happened to him. So when I got to New York in 93, I called him up and told him what I'd done with McLuhan and would he like to get together. And he said, "Well, I'm very busy." And he was. He was doing all the, in 93 to recently, he was a major guy in book publishing and stuff and on the internet. He was, I think he might have coined the word digerati. I'm not sure. Anyways, he said, no, you want to talk to Gerhard Stern, who I'd read about in Cliched Archetype, McLuhan refers to him. And so it wasn't until 7 years later, I never got in touch with Gerhard Stern at that point. I think I was a bit aware of his artwork. But anyways, in around 2000, one night I heard him on WBAI's Bob Fass's show. So I called in, and I think you can hear that on my timeline. You can hear me. I recorded me meeting Gerhard Stern, saying he was the guy I was looking for. So Mark Stallman invited Gerhard over to his loft in the summer of 2000, and Mark didn't like any of these McLuhanite guys or counterculture guys, but after him meeting and talking to Gerhard, he said, you know, he's the one guy, Bob, that you brought into my awareness from that counterculture world that is real. I like him. So Gerhard passed the Mark Stallman test, and Gerhard kept going on doing stuff with Brockman and Ed Rosenfeld. They had they eventually did a play in 2015-2016 about MK Ultra, you know, the Walter Boert history. He and Gerhard and Ed Rosenfeld, who knew the McLuhan scene in his own way. He was an early Digerati guy. So I went to that play. That was interesting, MK Ultra. But then Ed Rosenfeld died, and Gerhard is in his 90s. And I don't know what Gerd's doing today. I last talked to Gerhard about a year ago. So that's John Brockman. So what's funny is Amazing Polly discovers John Brockman. So she does videos exposing Brockman as a major asshole, you know, an extension of the world Davos conference, the WEF. So he's in the dumps as far as Amazing Polly is aware of. Now, she doesn't know the McLuhan world at all or anything. So she stumbled across Brockman through the Epstein things and then noticed he was connected to everything. And going back to all these people she was suspicious of the last 30, 40 years of history, Brockman's in the middle. So I find Brockman that it's funny that Brockman's getting nailed by Polly. So I end my point there. That's who Brockman is. So someone, you might want to look into his books, what he did. He did a book on science, on Einstein and Wittgenstein and a bunch of Steins in 86. And he had an article on the five types of subatomic particles. So for me to find out what the latest stuff on subatomic particles was, I used his book, his pages on that, and that went into my tiny note chart. That's where I got the five subatomic particles. So, okay, anybody want to say anything about this McLuhan Center?
Not that much. I mean, yeah, McLuhan's left the building.
Have you guys seen Palo's periodic table of McLuhan? Did you ever see that, Clinton?
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's pretty good.
He did an earlier pattern of all these sources to McLuhan, but then he took those names and made the periodic table and added some other themes. But is that out there much?
Oh, I don't know about out there much. I've seen it. But I don't think if there's a printed version posted on a wall in the real world, it's probably just in Paolo's office and, you know, wouldn't be allowed near the coach house at this point.
Where's Clinton? Clinton's not listed.
Oh, he said he might have to step out.
Okay. So Greg, what would you do in the McLuhan Center? It doesn't have to be just McLuhan Center, but if you had the coach house.
No Greg either.
It's not good, these people dropping off when they don't like the topic. Okay, Greg is trying to speak. Where are you, Greg? Your phone's broken. keep listening. Greg!
Yes, 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 yes. I'm here, I'm here.
Okay, what were you doing?
I had to go and help, I had to go and help Catherine with something.
Well, you're supposed to be listening. You always miss, when we do the McLuhan stuff, you miss it all the time. Not good.
I heard parts of it. I heard parts of it.
Okay, you're now head of the coach.
Bob, the thing I thought, if I could just say, when you said, what would Clinton do if he were made the head of the coach house? And I thought, if you had asked me that question, if you'd said, Greg.
I did ask you. That's what you're here for. You're going to get to talk.
This is the answer. I'd immediately make you, give you some position where you basically took over and gave me instructions. And I'd give some kind of role to Clinton and Brian and anybody else that you wanted that you felt needed input.
Yeah, but what would you, if I was not available, what would you do? How would you want to get a position of cultural influence? Or how would you do it if you were forced to do it?
Yeah.
What would you do?
Well, I think that I would, is it taking over a particular space?
You have an institution, you have funding, you can do anything, you got a budget, and you can do anything.
And where's the money coming from again?
Oh, that would be a secret.
Okay, what would I do? I'd try to avoid the land acknowledgments.
The what?
The land acknowledgments.
You mean the history of the natives?
I would try to avoid, like, starting every meeting with this.
Yeah.
We need to acknowledge this. I try to get around that and just by saying that in McLuhan's time, this wasn't done, not to be mean, but just because it's everybody else is doing it. We don't need to do it here because McLuhan probably didn't do that, and therefore it isn't along the lines of McLuhan.
Well, Greg, McLuhan predicted that. He says the new attention that the First Nations and the Inuit were giving, being in the art world, people started to look at it, and just acknowledging their presence, he knew that it had never happened before. He said the electric age will make us pay attention to those people. So he predicted that outcome, but it doesn't mean he was for it. He just said this won't happen inevitably. So we would point that out.
I wonder whether, I don't know enough about that. This is on another topic, but I guess, but since Clinton brought it up about the land acknowledgement, would there be a place you could go in Canada where it wouldn't be appropriate to do the land acknowledgement?
Yeah. Quebec? No. Newfoundland?
I don't know. Are there areas in Ontario where land acknowledgement is not necessary? Like where?
No, I think they're all over the place.
It's all over the place.
And like Prince Edward Island and Newfoundland would be potentially nothing going on there, but there would be Eskimos there or something. So
I know what to do because we've got a problem here. We've got a problem in Canada with this setting up a McLuhan thing. So first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to say, all right, I need to see some submissions from Aboriginal people, First Nations people in Canada who are really keen on McLuhan. Really keen. I need to see submissions. All right. No, I'm not going to get any. None of them will come in. And I'll be able to say, look, I went out, I specifically said that I wanted to see interest, people who are really keenly interested in a positive way with Marshall McLuhan. No, generally positive way. They're keen on him. And I didn't get a single one from any First Nations group in Canada. Now, if I did, then I'd say, hey, we got a bunch of submissions from First Nations people, and I'm going to poll them to see whether they think that it's appropriate, necessary, or otherwise needed to have a land acknowledgement in front of every meeting that we have. I'm going to poll them. I'm going to see what they
say.
That'd
be good.
All right. Now, of course, I'm allowing things. They don't know when I've gone out and I've asked for Native people who are keenly interested in McLuhan. They don't know I'm going down this road yet. Now they know I'm going down this road. Now, what are they going to do? Are they going to wimp out? Probably they're going to wimp out. But at least I've gone through it. At least I went through and I put that through. Okay, so that's clear. That'll be decided one way or another. All right? I'm not going to throw it. It'll be kind of obvious that I'm a bit dodgy about it. But anyway, I'm willing to hear from the affected group.
Yeah.
And
good.
Yeah.
Good idea.
So, okay, now I'm in charge, and I guess we're either doing land acknowledgements or we're not doing land acknowledgements.
Okay, that's a procedural thing. What would you do as course or as program content?
Well, I think the first thing I would do is I would have an exhibit, a curated exhibit about McLuhan for a period of time for people to come and educate themselves or familiarize themselves with McLuhan and what people are saying about McLuhan and what he thought was significant and what other people thought was significant about McLuhan. You know, like they have pictures of McLuhan up and like little exhibits. You go into a room and there'll be a movie about him, or come out of a room and there'll be little, you know, interactive stuff. And so you do this and you have a lot of publicity about doing this and opening up the world of McLuhan to people and getting publicity and talking about, you know, what's significant about him and giving ideas and people come and give a speech about it, not to Kirchhoff. We'll have you, Bob.
Right.
We'll have Clinton. Will come in. I mean, of course, if Clinton comes in, you have to go over what he's going to say. You have to go through and say, okay, that bit has to come out. Oh, change the order of that or whatever. You got to edit. I mean, Clinton needs to be edited, I think. That's showing. So far, anyway. I mean, Bob's a very good editor, and, you know, and Clinton has a lot of good ideas about McLuhan. And between the two of you, you know, work out some interesting way to present it. Have Clinton in. And you're not around, Bob. That's interesting. Can I consult with you, or are you dead?
No, basically I'm not there. Too busy.
You're not there.
Yeah.
Well, I guess what I would do is I would listen. I think I would try to listen to these shows, these programs, and other programs where you talk specifically or where you go into great depth about McLuhan and get ideas from you there.
Yeah, that's okay.
And of course, we'd have to try to get Croker in.
Yeah.
We'd get him out of his hibernation, and have him come in either, you know, in a virtual kind of way, or if he wants to fly in from Victoria, we'll do that. And I think that's where I begin. You know, just do a sort of publicity about it to get people, the general public interested. I think you got to get rid of these people who are McLuhan hangers-on and just there to use McLuhan to put forward some idiotic idea they have.
Okay, what about political stuff, which is what you actually know a lot about, regular politics? What would you do there?
Well, I think you'd try and present, in the exhibit, we'd have an area about politics and trying to decipher what McLuhan's politics actually were. There'd be a whole bit about Hitler was a radio man. That's probably the most important thing politically, I imagine, to discuss, because he made a particular point of that. Why was Hitler a radio man? And so on. That'd be a major area of discussion.
It could be a subtitle for the coach's name.
Yeah, Hitler was a radio man.
And we put the Hitler book up. The book is by Lewis. That's the price.
Oh yeah, yeah. Of course, we do that. It's very rare. Well, actually, we'd republish it. We try to get the rights to republish.
Yeah, right.
So it wouldn't be so rare. And then the B'nai B'rith would be down. You know, they'd come down.
We'd invite them in for dialogue. Yeah.
Yeah.
They would refuse to dialogue. They would just have protests outside.
That's right. Yeah. They'd be saying, this is wrong.
You're acknowledging McLuhan, which is good, but what about the politics in Canadian society and the world? You know, you don't have to be a McLuhanite to do that within the center. You represent politics. Would you just be a guy saying we need to have connections to North Korea, or would you be more...
I'd stay out of what I thought, because it'd be a McLuhan center. It's about what McLuhan thinks. Now, if in the process of getting more in depth with, I would think that you're like in a board situation. When I say board, a board of directors, or, you know, where you're a chairman, in a way, you're listening to what other people say, and if you have to break a tie, then it's up to you. But I think that it'd be more appropriate for, if let's say I were to take on this kind of role, forced into it, as you say, that I would stay out of making a lot of the decisions, unless I had to.
Yeah.
And unless it was forced upon me to make a decision. If there was a deadlock and these people who were involved, this group of people who are there for whatever reason, who are guiding this organization, I would act more as a break a tie. So that I'm not seen as having a particular point of view that I'm trying to put forward. I think that's inappropriate when you're, have an institute named after someone. I think, especially when they can't speak, you have to be careful about how it's guided and what you do and your own. And I think I'd be the perfect person, because I don't really have strong feelings about McLuhan. I mean, it's not to say that I'm not interested or that I couldn't become more interested and more knowledgeable, but I think that, I don't come with a lot of preconceived notions about it, which might come in handy. I mean, it might be a detriment, but it seems
and
to me...
And you also could make Ann be part of the animation department.
What would I do? I try and involve animation in it?
Yeah, maybe do variations of whatever we're doing as animation to put out
certainly
to attract children.
If there was some kind of an exhibit, I mean, if it came into it that there's film or video or sound or animation or this, that, and the other thing, yeah, I mean, I'd have some, you know, experience in doing that, and maybe be able to make some decisions about, good decisions, hopefully, about how it's presented and what would be a good expenditure of money, where to put the money, how to put emphasis, where you would spend money, where you might spend less, what would make it really important, and so on, which I think is sometimes it's a difficult thing to do, but it's an important thing that you know when you're putting the money into something, where it's worth putting the money into to get the value.
Okay, that's good. So Chad, and I'll unmute Brian, and I don't know where Clinton is. So everybody has pretty good ideas, right, Chad?
Yeah. Can you hear me, Bob?
Yeah.
Yep.
Okay. I was also thinking maybe you could have Nardwar come and host a symposium.
Yeah. Yeah, we would bring in anybody. Anybody who's interested or not afraid. The point would be make it a dialogue with as many functions going on as possible, which what the university's supposed to do, but doesn't. So we'll do a better university.
Yeah, it can't be a university. I mean, I think that's death.
Yeah,
in a way, it was always getting in the university was, and has, I suppose, always kind of been getting in the way of McLuhan, right?
Yep.
It's sort of the anti, it should be the anti-university.
Yeah. No, I agree. And that's what it would be.
I forgot to say, a thought I had while Clinton was going on and that I forgot to say in my answer to what I would do is that instead of, we would, like Greg was saying, we would, we would interrogate the idea of land acknowledgements and whether the people they're ostensibly for like them or not, or want them. But I was going to say that, yes, instead of land acknowledgements, we would do ground acknowledgements.
Yeah, good. Good point. So, okay, so you had good ideas. Clinton had good ideas. Chad had good ideas. And Greg, so that's pretty good. We have something to work with.
Was that an audition, Bob? I mean, is someone going to be the secret benefactor of this? And we just did an interview with you about who would be best to do that?
No comment.
Okay.